It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking with Wisconsin State epidemiologists now about COVID-19. That's as we navigate the new normal of living in a pandemic. And we're taking your calls. 800-642-1234. What do you think about the decrease in the number of positive coronavirus tests compared to all of the rest? Does it give you hope? Or have you not been thinking about it very much? Has it changed your behavior? What questions do you have about COVID-19? You can give us a call now at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Ryan Westergaard is the Chief Medical Officer and State Epidemiologist for Communicable Diseases for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Dr. Westergaard, good to have you back on the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Keely. How are you?
Good, thanks. On Tuesday, the number of positive coronavirus tests in Wisconsin, it dropped below 2% for the first time, 1.9% of the tests. But on Wednesday, yesterday, the percentage of positive tests was back up at 2.8%. What should we think about these daily fluctuations in the rate of tests that are coming back positive?
Well, I think we should be comfortable and encouraged that they are as low as they are. You know, there's certainly a period of time where it was up above 10%, and there are areas of the country where it's still that high. So we should feel good about that. In terms of the day-to-day fluctuation, we shouldn't actually read too much into it. You know, some labs have a turnaround time of a couple days. So in many cases, the test getting resulted and reported today reflect tests from yesterday, but sometimes they're from 2 to 3 days ago. So I think we just acknowledge that there's going to be a wavy line when we graph this out, and the day-to-day percent change from 2 to 3% shouldn't tell us too much.
And yet when we hear we're testing more people and fewer tests are coming back positive, there's a bit of hope there that I think creeps in, even if rationally we know that the COVID-19 spread is continuing.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Where we are in our epidemic is we're continuing to see low levels of community spread that are distributed very unequally, meaning there's some communities where it's higher. There are some hot spots in workplaces and in residential facilities. But overall, it's low, but frankly, not low enough. We still have a few thousand cases in Wisconsin every week, which is too many for us to feel like we really have it contained. We want to be in a position where new cases are rare, and when they do happen, we know where they came from and we can contain them quickly and give people recommendations about getting into isolation and quarantining contacts. At the number that they're at, even though they're somewhat lower than they had been, we're not quite there at a stage where we can do that effectively to really turn this epidemic off and feel like it's not an ongoing risk.
Well, toward the end of May, we were holding pretty steady at around 5% of coronavirus tests coming back positive. So, 2-3% does seem lower. You're saying it's just it's a different level of consistency when it comes to continued spread.
Yeah, there's a lot of different variables in play. When we look at the number of people who are severely ill, the number of people who are becoming hospitalized, that's been relatively flat. So the number of new cases as a percent also reflects how well we're doing in testing. And I think that's one of the things that we as a state have done pretty well. We've made testing more available in a lot of communities through publicly available tests where people can drive up and get a test from National Guard volunteers. A lot of hospitals have started screening new hospital admissions. So we're testing a lot of people who aren't sick. Which is a good thing. It's, if there are asymptomatic cases, so if we cast a wide net, we'll catch a large number. But the more we do that, the more we test, if the true prevalence stays the same, it's going to drive our percent positive down. So there's a lot of things that determine what that percent positive test is.
Dr. Ryan Westergaard is the Chief Medical Officer and the State Epidemiologist. He's also an Associate Professor in the Department of Medicine at UW-Madison. We're talking about the state's response in the COVID-19 pandemic, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What effect do you think these recent protests will have on the pandemic here in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country? Do you think we'll see a second wave of COVID-19 infections this spring or this fall? How are you thinking about this disease? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Westergaard, you mentioned asymptomatic carriers. We have had some confusion this week as the World Health Organization was talking about it. First, the WHO said asymptomatic carriers rarely spread the virus, which contradicted the CDC and others, and then the WHO walked that back. What do we know about people who don't show symptoms and whether they spread COVID-19?
Well, I agree with you. It was a confusing couple of days all around. What we know with relative certainty is that people can have high levels of the virus in their throat, in their nose, and in their respiratory secretions, meaning when they sneeze or cough, early in the case course of illness, so before they start showing symptoms. And we know that we can detect similar levels of virus among people who have the infection but never show symptoms. We also know that it is possible that those individuals can spread the virus to other people. I think the uncertainty that was reflected in the World Health Organization press conference was that as a proportion of all the new cases, all the transmission that happens, how much did people without symptoms account for new cases? And there's reasons to think that it would be less, which makes sense. People aren't sneezing and coughing. They're not having symptoms. They're not spreading those infectious particles around. And that's something we don't have enough information to say precisely, Luke, what is the risk? What percentage of people transmit virus when they're asymptomatic? So there's, I feel, relative certainty that it does happen and that that's ample justification for the recommendations we give people to be in isolation, even if they don't have symptoms, and to quarantine people who have been had a close contact or exposed to an individual. Those are really the critical interventions that we have to stop the spread. But the uncertainty about what's the overall percentage of new cases that result from asymptomatic spread still needs to work out. We need more data to know what that is.
So in Wisconsin, when it comes to testing, then we have people who do not have symptoms, who have certain exposure or suspect exposure. So they go in and they get tested and they're tested negative. As we see the number of positive cases in Wisconsin drop compared to overall testing, does that change our strategy when it comes to testing for COVID-19?
Well, I think our strategy has always been to make testing easy and accessible and widespread. So I don't think our strategy has changed. I think there's some, as we move in through the summer and into the fall, there are things that we're going to need to do more and better, which is to make it much easier for people to get a test when they have symptoms. As everyone knows, cold and flu season really starts in the fall, and there's going to be more people who have symptoms, and it's going to become increasingly important for us to know people who develop symptoms, do they have the common cold, do they have influenza, or do they have COVID-19? And the better we have a system to capture, to do those tests early, to give people the advice to keep people safe and get people in isolation, the better. So I would say we're doing pretty well right now with testing in community settings. Our next big challenge is to really figure out how we do primary health care, urgent care, emergency care differently going into the fall, where we can capture and get testing for a really high proportion of people who come in with respiratory symptoms, because the water is going to get muddied when people start getting sick with other respiratory viruses, and there's going to be a lot of value in knowing precisely when and where the coronavirus is spreading.
Does Wisconsin have a plan for that?
Yes, we're working with healthcare partners. We're working with laboratories to make sure that we have access to the necessary testing reagents. There's ongoing manufacturing of the so-called point-of-care tests, the instruments that can test for COVID-19 in an office setting or near the patient. So all those things are trying to get scaled up. And we, in healthcare systems, are looking forward to figure out the best way to put these systems in place. But, you know, this is still a new problem. The technology is developed, but it needs to be scaled up, and it's going to take some time.
Yeah, Dr. Ryan Westergaard is Wisconsin State Epidemiologist, taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about COVID-19? You're listening to this conversation on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking with state epidemiologist Dr. Ryan Westergaard about the latest on COVID-19 in Wisconsin. We have more than 2 million cases in the United States. The latest numbers from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services are that our state has had more than 21,000 positive tests for the disease, just over 357,000 negative tests, and 671 people in Wisconsin have died from COVID-19. What do you want to know about the state's response to this health crisis? You're part of this conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Have you been tested for COVID-19? What are you thinking about as the pandemic continues? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And we've got Eric from Middleton on the line looking ahead. Hi, Eric.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you know, I'm thinking about like with summer school or like with schools in the fall, and just like what's the state doing to help schools reopen? And I mean, you know, schools they're running on a budget deficit as it is. So I mean, in terms of getting everything set up and precautions and testing, and what happens like when there's an outbreak in schools? And I mean, we've already closed schools down, so you know, I'm just concerned that we're really going to never get ahead of this thing.
Eric, thank you for that question. And Dr. Westergaard, school's just getting out now, but many people like Eric looking to the fall and wondering what's going to happen.
Yeah, thanks, Derek. I agree. It's one of our biggest challenges. When the epidemic started to spread in the country and in the region, the decision to close schools happened relatively abruptly. All of our neighboring states sort of did it over a 48-hour period, and it was out of an abundance of caution that we really didn't know how quickly or how bad this was going to go. As time has gone by and going into the fall, it's given us some time to really do the two pieces of this. One is for schools to try to figure out how to do education differently, a mix between, you know, smaller in-person classes and being able to pivot to distance learning and computer learning. It's not perfect, but I think they've learned some skills, and I know the Department of Public Instruction is trying to give districts tools on how to continue educational programs if we need to do that again. The big challenge, though, is how to make those decisions and when to give local school superintendents the best advice about when it makes sense to do that and what's the role of closing schools in the overall spread of the epidemic. And we're still working kind of on those data with, you know, CDC and modeling data to really be able to give people the best advice. But I think that what the schools are doing right now is just trying to prepare to be flexible, to do school differently. And what does it look like if we get to a situation where we need to do things differently? But I think
All right, we'll try to reconnect with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, who is helping us understand how schools are trying to plan for what happens in the fall and how the school year might look different based on the level of COVID-19 that we're seeing and how fast it travels among people. Dr. Westergaard, you still there?
I'm here, yes. Sorry, I forgot.
Excellent. No problem. It happens. It's live radio. I want to ask you about protests, though, because that's happening now. Over the past 2 weeks, there have been many protests against police brutality here in Wisconsin, I mean, and across the country following the death of George Floyd, who was killed at the hands of police in Minneapolis. How are you thinking about these protests as thousands of people were in close proximity and how it could affect how this spreads in our state?
Yeah, we're certainly watching it very closely, and I would say our priority at the state health department level and in our communication with local health departments are really giving local communities and individuals tools they need to do things safely. We've learned as things have gone on that, you know, in a situation where there's community spread, there's likely no activities that are zero risk, but there are ways to do essential things in public and do gatherings safely. And I would say we've learned a lot more in the past 2 months about the benefits of wearing face coverings and masks in public. We've become more certain that the role of physical distancing, of keeping 6 feet between people, has a major impact on reducing the likelihood of transmission. So we're trying to really focus on those key infection prevention messages that when people are doing the things that they need to do for their communities, whether it be gather in public in protest or the essential activities, to have these core prevention strategies in mind, which is, you know, staying out of close contact with other people, paying more attention to those things when you're in situations where there's loud talking or shouting or singing, and just be mindful continually of the way respiratory viruses are spread and the things we can do to prevent them.
Dr. Ryan Westergaard is the chief medical officer and state epidemiologist with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. And we're taking your calls about COVID-19 at 800-642-1234. Whether it's about the disease or how to prevent it or how you're managing life right now during a pandemic, we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And Dr. Westergaard, you mentioned face masks, and in southeastern Wisconsin, Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley on Tuesday announced a new requirement for county employees and residents who use most county facilities to wear face masks to help stop the spread of COVID-19. What are your thoughts on public policy requiring face masks?
Well, I think it's reasonable in indoor environments, in companies and office settings, as a strategy to try to have universal precautions. And in some ways, it can be more normalizing and less stigmatizing to say that this is going to just be our normal procedure, our normal practice in a workplace or a place of business or an office, to say that this is going to be something we're committed to as a group to keep each other safe. I don't think laws in general public have been received well, or that they're a good strategy. But in local communities and office settings, I think it can be a way to really show that we care about keeping each other safe, and it's a good way to sort of take some of the discussion or opinions or feelings out of it, to say, here, this is something we're doing as a community group or as an organization to lower our risk collectively.
Would it be fair to say you think that it would take the politics out of the decision?
I think so. I think if a group of people have come together around a mission in their workplace or their organization, and they say we're going to all do this regardless of our personal feelings, what we do outside, I think it's a way to move forward and feel comfortable that we're doing this as with a shared sense of purpose, rather than having people make individual decisions. So I've seen in organizations and workplace that work well.
All right. David from Boscobel is on the line, wants to join our conversation. David, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, I have a question for your guest about antibody testing. You don't really hear about it anymore, and wondering when on request antibody testing is available. I run a small company. We're looking to bring all of our employees back into our office, and we contacted two different medical centers to see if we could get antibody testing done to see if any of our employees have the antibodies, and we cannot get anybody to do it. And, early on that was talked about as, one of the most important things that we could ever get to is antibody testing besides a vaccination, and now you hear nothing about it. And it's very frustrating for me as an employer and for our employees, or just in general, someone who cares for elderly sick people, to know if they're exposing, if they have the antibodies, so they're not exposing these at-risk individuals. So I appreciate your feedback. Thank you.
David, thanks for the question. Dr. Westergaard, what about antibody testing and availability in Wisconsin?
Yes, it's a terrific question. There's been a lot of information, a lot of hope, but a number of concerns that I think it's important for people to understand. So the two issues with antibody testing, and of course, for those that don't know, antibodies are the proteins that your body makes in response to an infection. So it's a different kind of test compared to the one that tells us whether you have the infection. It actually tells us whether someone's been infected in the past. So it can be potentially useful to say who's been exposed, who's been infected, and potentially recovered. The two problems is it was initially when the antibody tests were developed and came out, they didn't work very well. They cross-react, meaning they were turned positive for a lot of people that never had COVID-19, and that's something that's true of antibody tests. They aren't necessarily specific to the infection that we care about. The other thing, and I think this is a more important consideration, is that we don't yet know, we don't have enough research to know how well having an antibody makes someone safe or protected or immune from getting the infection. There are lots of infectious diseases where someone can have antibodies in their blood and they're still at risk to getting infection a second time. There are, of course, other diseases, the ones we use vaccines for, where antibodies do protect you, sometimes lifelong. But it's too early for us to know whether having an antibody actually makes somebody safe from being infected or infecting. So I think that's really the limitation of antibody testing right now, and the reason that we're not recommending it be a part of the the decisions about going back to work.
Being with Dr. Ryan Westergaard, who's the chief medical officer and state epidemiologist. And we were just talking about antibody testing and whether that would be an option or an available option here in Wisconsin to figure out if people have had COVID-19. It sounds like we've lost the connection as we're wrapping up our conversation. So certainly want to thank Dr. Ryan Westergaard for being with us and catching us up on the latest when it comes to the state's response to COVID-19. We've talked about the numbers in Wisconsin, how those are changing, how we should think about those, and what we should do with that information as we figure out how to live life during a pandemic. Dr. Ryan Westergaard, Chief Medical Officer, State Epidemiologist for Communicable Diseases for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. He's also an Associate Professor in the Department of Medicine at UW-Madison. Up next is news. Then we'll find out from a pair of delivery drivers what it's like to bring food, whether it's groceries or restaurant takeout, to your door during a pandemic. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We're talking about what it's like to be a personal shopper in a pandemic. The specifics may be different depending on the company, but here's the gist. Customers stay home, they pick out what they want from a store online and submit the order. Then someone with the third-party service picks up the items, checks out, and delivers them. Customers pay a little more for the convenience and tip, but they don't leave the house. And that means delivery workers are on the go all the time. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and you're part of this conversation we're having with people who shop for other people during a global health crisis. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Have you been delivering food during this pandemic? What's the job like? What do you think of the work? Or have you relied on food delivery services like Instacart during the pandemic? What do you think of the service, and do you have any reservations? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We have two guests with us now. Marquise Mason is the youth program lead at Kennedy Heights Community Center in Madison. He's been delivering groceries for Instacart since March. Marquise, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
And we are also talking with Jessica Brem, who's been delivering food in the Milwaukee area for DoorDash for a year and also delivering groceries for Instacart since August. Jessica, thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you.
Marquise, let's start here. You work for the Kennedy Heights Community Center in Madison. Why did you start working for Instacart, too?
With the pandemic kind of suddenly just happening, and us not really having an idea what was going on, we decided to shut down our programming. So until we got we're one of the fortunate people to get one of the grants, so we're getting paid now. But I was just looking for a way, one, to get out the house. I had a newborn, and, when you have newborns, you immediately think about money and, how secure you are. So I was thinking of the easiest way possible to make money quickly, and that's when I came across Instacart.
What is it like to buy someone else's groceries?
Honestly, I signed up for it a couple years ago, and it's really weird, and so it took me a while to get used to do my first delivery, but once you do it, it's fine. It's great, because you get to fulfill people's orders and stuff without really having to try to work too hard in other areas, but it's also kind of stressful depending on what store you're in, and kind of just makes you realize how how you don't know the store layout very well.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that you learn that very quickly when you're trying to find things that maybe you don't normally buy, but this person wants to. Jessica Brem, how did you get started doing this work?
I was a stay-at-home mom, so I was like thinking about ways I could make money. And Dash at the time was like, I was making like maybe like $5 here and there for just delivering fast food. So I was like, my husband came across Instacart just popped up through Facebook, and I was like, okay, well, I'll give it a try. And then we joined a group on Facebook, and everyone was saying, like, they make so much money. So it was, like, $20 here for, like, one delivery. So that's, like, in an hour. So I'm like, okay, well, I'll give that a try. And it was something I could do that while being a stay-at-home mom. So.
And what has your experience been like as we've transitioned to this kind of work during the pandemic? Have things changed for you?
The tips got higher, so like the money got better. Like a lot of people were making thousands of dollars a month just on Instacart. So it helped because of the fact that, like, a lot of people lost their jobs, and with quarantine and stuff, many people relied on this service.
Marquise, are you able to make a decent living doing this, or is it really in the side gig category?
Honestly, I've had nothing but great experience. I started the first official week of pandemic, and I made $3,000 in 19 days working a total of like 45 hours. So, not that it could replace my job, but it was a great supplement, for me, and I will continue to do it.
Has it stayed steady at that kind of a level? I mean, if someone signs up to do this, should they expect that continuously?
I think you're kind of lured in, from what I've been reading. I also joined the group that Jessica joined as well. And I think you're kind of lured in the first as a new shopper. So I was getting anywhere, they're called batches. And there's usually one or two batches depending on, what store you're at. But long story short, you know, I was making $200 a day. it's been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. And Jessica, what about when it comes to tips? These services allow people to put a tip in at the beginning, but then I understand that sometimes they can change it. What's your experience been with the money that individual customers say that they're going to give you for doing this, you know, work that does expose you more to other people when we have a contagious disease going around?
Some people like the tip bait, and they will put in like $50 for a tip, and you think it's a really good batch. You take it, you do their shopping, which is like probably like 80 to 100 some units, and it takes you about an hour, hour and a half. You deliver it to their house, wasting your gas, and you're so good about delivering their groceries, and you move on to the next, and then that night you find out they took the whole entire tip away. So it does put a damper on them, that they can actually take the tip away. Like, we're trying to tell Instacart, like, they should have to jump through hoops before they can take the tip completely away.
Is the idea that you should be able to change the tip if you got exceptional service, or if the worker didn't quite do it right, so you can make that adjustment? Is that the concept in not committing to the tip overall?
Basically, yeah.
Sure. Okay.
That's basically it.
Sure. So there's a reason there that maybe somebody might want to, good or bad, adjust a tip, but you're saying that people are using it in a way that is mm-hmm. undermining to your service that you're giving them, Jessica.
Right. Because like some people would order a week in advance, and then they wouldn't be able to get to their, because we're so backed up that they wouldn't be able to get to their list of stuff right away. So they would put on a high tip. So their shopping experience would be the first priority, and they would get their food faster than everybody else that's been waiting longer. So basically that's why they do it. Another way that we lose our tip or some of it is if the store is out of what they want. So I don't see how that could be like, why is that our fault?
Right. It's not your fault that the store is out of eggs, but you didn't give it to me, yeah. So I'm gonna dock your tip. We are talking about what it's like to buy other people's groceries during the pandemic. We are hearing from Jessica Brehm and also from Marquise Mason. And we have Elizabeth from Kenosha on the line at 800-642-1234. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
What's your experience?
Well, I do Instacart, Grubhub, Uber Eats, and DoorDash. So I pretty much do everything, and I pretty much work the Kenosha or Scene Market. I've never had a problem on Instacart with chip baiting. I know some shoppers have had that. Thankfully, I haven't had that kind of problem I have. Instacart's generally been pretty good for me. The problem I have is more on the food delivery side with DoorDash, Grubhub, and Uber Eats. One of the things that really has been a problem for me, and I think it's been a problem for a lot of drivers, but we don't talk about it very much, is the need to go to the bathroom when we're out there delivering. You know, a lot of restaurants are still closed. They're still doing curbside takeout, drive-through, and app ordering. And a lot of these restaurants have barricaded their bathrooms. They put tables, they put chairs. It's like Mount Vesuvius to get to their bathrooms. And a lot of them will put out of order or closed signs up. And I recently asked at Chipotle, because I had to go to the bathroom really bad before I picked up my order. I said, you know, I would really like to use your restroom before I pick up my order. And the guy says, well, if I let you use it, I'm going to get in trouble. You know, and I've struggled to figure out where to go during the bathroom throughout this whole process the last 3 months. Thankfully, a lot of the quick trips, I can usually go in there and use a restaurant, or same thing with like Walgreens or CVS Pharmacy. Their restrooms are open to me. But these restaurants, they get really kind of agitated, I guess, is what I'm looking for, when you ask if you can use their restroom. They just won't let you use it. And I don't know why DoorDash, Grubhub, and Uber Eats can't reach out to these restaurants and say, please let our delivery partners, if they have to use your restroom, use your restroom. Because you have a lot of drivers, they have such a problem figuring out where to go. They have toilet paper in the car. They have disinfectants. They have hand sanitizer in the car. They're using Mother Nature out there in secluded spots to literally go to the bathroom.
Elizabeth, thank you for raising that with us. And Marquise, we're short on time in this moment, but it sounds like you understand. It's hard to take care of yourself when doing this work.
Yeah, 100%. Instacart has done a great job, I guess, a decent job in sending us safety kits, but ultimately it really comes down to how well you're prepared when you're going into the stores. I generally keep disinfectant spray, a mask, and gloves if I have them available in my car, just in case.
Marquise Mason and Jessica Brehm are our guests. Thanks again to caller Elizabeth at 800-642-1234. We're talking about what it's like to deliver groceries for people right now, and we are taking your calls. What do you want to know about the conditions for people doing this kind of work? Are you torn, or do you think that people are being paid a wage to shop for you so you don't have to put yourself at risk, and that's good enough? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guests stay with us here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about food delivery services in the pandemic. We heard from a worker in Racine who shops and delivers groceries during the day and spends all evening dropping off food orders. They write, I get home, shower, and get ready for bed. Sleeping is often difficult. In the morning, I get up and sometimes find it hard to go out and do my deliveries. But I tell myself I need to go and make money, otherwise I can't pay my bills. Are you living this life? Are you a food delivery server, driver? Do you feel safe doing this work right now? What do you think about when you order groceries online to be delivered to your house? What moral quandaries do you have? 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org. Jessica, as we just heard in that message, this work can be really grueling. Jessica Brehm in Milwaukee, you work for Instacart and DoorDash. How has it been for you?
Pretty
scary, basically. You're going into stores with during this pandemic and stuff. So you have to, like, make sure you wear a mask. And I was wearing gloves in the beginning, but I found it kind of hard to try to not cross-contaminate. So I just feel like it's easier just to sanitize my hands afterwards. So I'm just constantly sanitizing my hands before I touch my card and after I touch my card, stuff like that, and try to stay safe as possible since I have little kids at home. But yeah, sometimes I forget my mask and I have to go back to my car and get it, but it's frustrating, but hanging in there.
Do you think about that balance when you go to work, thinking about the little kids you have at home and your safety as you are around so many people doing this work?
Yeah, I do. I try to stay a distance away from people. And it helps that the shoppers have a door, leave it a door service. So I just leave it, give them a text, like with a picture that it's here, and I go.
Marquise Mason, do you feel like you're putting yourself at risk for COVID-19 when you do this work?
Yeah, I do. And it's something we have a newborn. So my fiance was on high alert. So just as an expert, you know how that goes. You just don't know. But what was nice in the beginning is that Instacart shoppers had an open window. So we weren't really in the, I primarily do Costco because it's the biggest batches. It's the easiest way to make the most money in the shortest amount of time. So we actually, at the time, we had an open window where we were in there at 6 a.m. So we were only in there with the stockers. But when I'm done every day, I have a change of clothes in my garage. I change my clothes and I use my downstairs shower, and then I come back up stairs to the rest of the family. But that's just my precaution, and my kind of thought behind it is, I'm not going out and going to the bars or going out and going to these large gatherings. I'm going out to make money. So that's the thought process behind that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you have to weigh to support your family.
100%.
We're talking with Marquise Mason from Madison, who works for Instacart, and Jessica Brem from Milwaukee, who works for Instacart and DoorDash. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234 as we talk about what it's like to deliver food and groceries during a pandemic. And Nicole from Milwaukee wants to join the conversation. Hey, Nicole.
Hi there.
What are you thinking about?
I just wanted to add in another comment about the tips that we get that I think is important for people to know, is that I don't think they know that Instacart, when it comes to tips, that's kind of what we live off of most, is the tips, because Instacart's not that great at paying us for these orders.
Okay. Yeah, so you deliver for Instacart then. You shop for other people.
I do, yeah.
What motivated you to do that, Nicole?
I'm a stay-at-home mom, and with the pandemic, my husband's hours dropped dramatically. So I needed a way to help keep our income steady and keep the bills paid.
Yeah. Nicole, thank you so much for sharing that aspect of your life right now, and also raising the question about how pay works. Marquise, how does Instacart decide how much to pay workers for each order?
So they have you make a minimum of $7, and then they multiply that by the distance traveled from, and Jessica, you can jump in too, just in case I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure they multiply it by, 60 cents per mile. So it's however many miles from the grocery store. And then it also calculates the weight of, the order as well.
The weight of the order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not necessarily about how many items. So for instance, at Costco, I can get an order. I can get paid $87 total, 30 from Instacart and 50 for tips, and only have about 20 items. But that may be, four bags of water softener. And just because of the weight of it, you get paid more.
Interesting. Jessica, you have a similar experience. How much of what you think, what you take home, is actually tips versus what you get paid?
Basically, Instacart, like sometimes I have seen where Instacart will pay, there'll be a heavy order, but they won't pay that much. They have been known to, so I would say like by what I take home, I will probably get more tips than from Instacart. I have seen that I get more, I thought it was really ridiculous. Like it'll be drastic. Like the tips would be $100 more than what Instacart pays me a week. There are times like there'll be so many items on a list and Instacart will pay like $7. So like there'll be like 80 units and the whole thing between tips and Instacart would be like $9. I'm like, so some people won't take it because they're like, well, that's not worth it.
Yeah. I wonder, I don't shop for other people. This is not the work that I do. And yet I struggle a little bit thinking about, should I be ordering and having other people, as you've both said, put yourselves at risk to pick up groceries for me? And, you know, is that okay? And at the same time, maybe rationalizing a little bit and saying, well, you know, if I have them do it, then at least I'm one fewer person that they have to try to avoid in the aisles. How do you talk to people about whether you want them to use the service, Marquise?
So it basically comes down to how you feel and how you, you know, feel about grocery shopping. I mean, for me, if I was someone that was using Instacart, it's kind of a no-brainer for me. In a way, it's selfish, but it's not. You know, again, these, like I said, the shoppers, you know, we aren't just going out and just lollygagging around. We're making money. So if I can pay someone to get my groceries, you know, I'll do that. You know, it's one of those things where Instacart is a choice. And I think as a customer, I think you know that. So, it's kind of a give and take type of situation.
Yeah. Jessica, what do you say to people who are considering using this service? Do you encourage them to? How do you want them to treat you?
I mean, it's a great service. Like you order groceries online, it gets delivered to you. I mean, it can't get any better than that. The customers I have been, I hear about customers treating people badly, but I have never seen it. I always had great customers.
Good. So just treat you picking up their groceries the same way you treat any other worker, any other service worker. Respect, dignity, those basic human principles.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. We'll try to certainly operate on that. Jessica, we really appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
And Marquise, thank you for your experience, too.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Marquise Mason is the youth program lead at Kennedy Heights Community Center in Madison. He's been delivering groceries for Instacart since March. And Jessica Brem has been delivering food in the Milwaukee area for DoorDash for a year and started delivering groceries for Instacart in August. And we did have a caller, Sean from Milwaukee, noted that it's really hard to understand what the calculation is for payment beyond the base for Instacart. And it would be nice to know because it's difficult to understand. Just ahead, we talk with the NPR Student Podcast Challenge leaders and get to hear from one of the contest's honorable mentions from Verona Area High School. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.